Chapter 2, The Five Tribal Stages. Entering Griffin Hospital in Derby, Connecticut is like going to Nordstrom's for healthcare. The first clue that this isn't a normal healthcare company is the valet who squeegees car windows and knows many patients by name. Walk through the front entrance, and the first thing you notice is piano music, soft and elegant, coming from the baby grand in a niche just beside the front door. The second thing you notice is the smell, fresh flowers and wood. In recent years, Griffin has drawn international attention as not only a great hospital but a great employer, ranking fourth on the Fortune list of best places to work in its seventh year on that list. There are many heroes in the Griffin Hospital story, but two stand out as tribal leaders because their efforts have gone a long way to upgrade the tribal culture. The first is President and CEO Patrick Charmel. Tall, lean, mid-40s, dark hair, soft-spoken, self-effacing, a caring tone in his voice, he seems a cross between a high-tech entrepreneur and a priest. Charmel started with Griffin as an intern while attending a local university, then went to Yale for his Master of Public Health degree and returned as a full-time employee. He told us, "Some people still remember me as someone who is 19 years old. No matter what position, they don't mind telling me when I mess up." The second hero is Vice President Bill Pawanda, mid-60s, gray, fast-talking, and charming. He is easily moved by the human side of the story. Although Griffin has many lines of communication with the community, Pawanda is the perfect person to carry the flame to the outside world. He was born at Griffin and is a former state senator, former board chair of the local Chamber of Commerce. Charmel started as Pawanda's intern, and they have worked together for 28 years. Today's success is far different from what longtime Griffin employees call the perfect storm of the mid-1980s, when the hospital had the oldest physical plant in the state, falling patient satisfaction and market share, and difficulty recruiting staff and physicians. The community was transforming from a manufacturing town in decline to a bedroom community with an influx of young, educated, mobile residents with higher expectations for their health care. Griffin's board authorized a community perception survey and asked local residents this question: "If there is a hospital you'd avoid, please name it." Of those who responded, 32% hand-wrote Griffin. The hospital, it seemed, was doomed and without any resources to stop the death spiral. As we see again and again with tribal leaders, Charmel and Pawanda didn't save the hospital Superman style, swooping in to save the day. Rather, they galvanized the tribe of employees, volunteers, board members, and community leaders whose opinions mattered, and the turnaround was a tribal effort. In a sense, Charmel didn't lead it. He nudged it, and then was led by it. And he humbly credits the entire Griffin team for its success. He told us, "Our success really is a testament to the culture. Looking back, it's clear we never could have accomplished this without engaging our employees and getting them involved in the process. I think that's what distinguishes this approach." It started with the question whether Griffin should remain independent or join another healthcare system. Pawanda, glancing out the window of his office, says, "We are a fiercely independent and competitive community, and people are used to getting everything they need here, from shopping to church." Griffin decided to remain independent and to rebuild itself into a hospital that would put the patient first. One operation at a time, Griffin executives focused the staff on the problem and facilitated their finding the solution. A board member argued that if this institution created satisfied patients in the maternity ward, Griffin would keep many of them for years. "But what did they want? Let's ask them," the board member advised. Pawanda told us, "We went on a marketing research tear. We were pioneers in the industry." Griffin launched surveys and focus groups, and Charmel and a staff member posed as husband and pregnant wife, thanks to a pillow, and toured maternity wards at nearby hospitals. He told us, "We put together a long list of what young parents wanted. It included a separate hospital entrance, since expectant mothers said they weren't sick and didn't want to be around sick people. Double beds, a jacuzzi for pain relief and early labor, family rooms with kitchens, 24/7 visiting hours, fresh flowers, a spa-like atmosphere, and personalized treatment by pleasant staff." With this long list in hand, the executive sat down to prioritize the enhancements they would offer. In a move that revealed Charmel's tribal orientation, he stopped the process and asked, an atypical edge in his voice, "What are we doing?" After an awkward moment, he continued, "We know what they want. Let's give it all to them." Griffin's leaders agreed, and design work started on a new maternity ward that would set the new standard in the Northeast. The challenge was to involve staff as partners, in the same way that the executives and board members were collaborating. Instead of telling employees the new vision, Charmel, then assistant to the president, and other executives led a series of all-day staff retreats, taking 1/12 of the employees at a time. In the morning, one of the executives would describe the perfect storm. Then they would ask the staff to take the perspective of patients and to answer the question, "What would you want your hospital experience to be?" As Pawanda says, lo and behold, they described a scene dramatically different from Griffin and the nation's hospitals. Open visiting, more information about their medical condition, caring staff, and they were the staff. It was an awakening experience for everyone. Almost every one of the 12 groups came up with the same list of what they'd want, and the chatter at the hospital began to turn toward quality, service, respect, and dignity, now the pillars of Griffin's core values. During one part of the new building design process, Charmel suggested that Griffin build a full-scale mock-up of the critical components of the new design in a warehouse. Staff members all made suggestions on small strips of paper, eventually giving hundreds of recommendations to the architects. Pawanda adds, to this day, people will point to a wall outlet and say, "It used to be over there until I suggested they move it." Charmel, promoted to chief operating officer, clashed with the CEO, who thought the solution for Griffin was to focus on its wholly owned HMO. Charmel disagreed with the transfer of financial resources from Griffin Hospital to support the growth of the HMO. This shift was thwarting patient service and damaging Griffin's ability to fulfill its mission. The fight resulted in Charmel's termination. With the popular chief operating officer fired, a revolution began. An underground employee newsletter appeared, urging staff members to wear a yellow ribbon, save Griffin, and bring back Pat Charmel. After 3 months of turmoil, including petitions, votes of no confidence, and community meetings, the board, acting on advice from consultants and an investigative committee, asked the CEO and the executive vice president to resign. The board asked Charmel to return. On the day Charmel came back to Griffin, now as interim CEO, over 400 staff members, volunteers, community leaders, and members of the press welcomed him back with a surprise reception in the hospital entrance, filled with yellow balloons. It was an emotional, tribal moment for Griffin. The level of loyalty to Griffin and Charmel is stunning. It survived the layoffs that followed his return, difficult decisions including closing the money-losing HMO, and even a potential panic after the nation's fifth anthrax death at Griffin in 2001. As a result, so many people want to see the Griffin miracle that the hospital now charges visitors from other hospitals who want to use the Griffin patient-centered care model within their organization. Teams representing almost 600 hospitals have paid to see Griffin for themselves. The United States Secretary of Health and Human Services appointed Charmel to the National Advisory Council for Research and Quality in 2005. Charmel's office features 7 years of Fortune magazine Best Employer covers. Tribal Leadership Up Close. What did Sharmell and Pawanda do that was different from what most leaders do? First, they spent most of their efforts building strong relationships between Griffin's tribal members, its employees, volunteers, and patients. Second, instead of telling people what to do, they engineered experiences, such as the retreats, in which staff members would look at the same issues they were dealing with, so that the strategy became everyone's problem. Third, they got out of the way and let people contribute in their own way to the emerging tribal goals. Most important, and hardest to see, they unstuck Griffin's tribal culture and nudged it forward, stage by stage, until people charged after problems with the zeal of converts, not the indifference of hired guns. In a sentence, this is what Sharmell and Pawanda did. They built the tribe, and as they did, people recognized them as the leaders. The more Sharmell and Pawanda put the tribe first, the more people respected and identified them, giving their efforts more credibility and impact. This is tribal leadership in a nutshell, and this is what you'll be able to do after mastering the principles in this audiobook. Today, when patients come in, they aren't treated as customers, but rather members of the tribe. Doctors build relationships between patients and nurses. Volunteers talk up the quality of the physicians to patients. Administrators bring people together and allow the tribe to decide what's best. Years after the perfect storm passed, Griffin is a hospital with wall-to-wall leaders. Every tribe has a dominant culture, which we can peg on a 1-5 scale, with stage 5 being the most desirable. All things being equal, a 5 culture will always outperform a 4 culture, which will outperform a 3, and so on. People and groups only move one stage at a time, and the actions that advance people from stage 1 to stage 2 are different from those that will advance them from 2 to 3. Since each stage has a unique set of leverage points that will nudge people forward, most of the so-called universal principles from most popular business books will work only in one stage. Try them in another stage and your efforts will fail. If tribes are the most powerful vehicles within companies, cultures are their engines. Sharmell and Pawanda inherited a set of overlapping tribes. Remember, a tribe is at most 150 people, with an engine in need of repair. In tribal leadership language, they had dominant stage 2 cultures. The leaders unstuck people and guided them to a 3. They used a different set of leverage points to bump people to a 4. On its best days, and Griffin has many best days, it operates at a 5. We now turn to the 5 tribal stages in detail. Stage 1. Fortunately, most professionals skip stage 1. Only about 2% of American professionals operate here at any given point, which is the mindset that creates street gangs and people who come to work with shotguns. If people at stage 1 had t-shirts, they would read, "Life sucks," and what comes out of their mouths supports this adage. People at this stage are despairingly hostile, and they band together to get ahead in a violent and unfair world. Although most people reading this book will not have been in stage 1, they've seen it on HBO's Oz or Fox's Prison Break. Most anthropologists say that human society started at stage 1, clans scratching out an existence while fighting with one another. Chapter 4 goes into what you need to know about stage 1, how to spot it, and how to assist people in it to move forward. Stage 2. In 25% of workplace tribes, the dominant culture is stage 2, which is a quantum leap from stage 1. People operating at stage 2 use language centered on "my life sucks." People in this culture stage are passively antagonistic. They cross their arms in judgment, yet never really get interested enough to spark any passion. Their laughter is quietly sarcastic and resigned. The stage 2 talk is that they've seen it all before and watched it all fail. A person at stage two will often try to protect his or her people from the intrusion of management. The mood that results from stage two's theme, "My life sucks," is a cluster of apathetic victims. If you've ever walked into a meeting and presented a new idea with passion, only to get looks back of passivity, you've probably walked into a stage two culture. Stage two is what we see when we watch The Office or walk into the Department of Motor Vehicles. There is little or no innovation and almost no sense of urgency, and people never hold one another accountable for anything. During the perfect storm at Griffin, the company had a dominant stage two culture. Most large companies have pockets of stage two, often divisions that don't have an impact on strategy or direction. Although stage two can appear in any discipline, we've seen it most often in human resources, procurement, and accounting. That said, we've also seen stage two in boards of directors, executive suites, sales, and operations. Years ago, we consulted to an agency of the United States government. When we showed up, employees and managers would stand in the doors of their offices and entrances to their cubicles, looking out at a shared hallway. People looked as if they just woke up, and many had. They would hold coffee mugs flaunting messages like, "I'd rather be fishing," and "I live for the weekends." No amount of team building, motivational speeches, discussions of core values, or any new strategic plans would make any difference with this tribe. It was solidly locked in stage two. As a result, very little got done. The tribe produced few new ideas and almost never followed up on them. The focus of tribal leadership is to move stage two to three before asking anything new of the group. Chapter 5 gives the leverage points. Stage 3. The theme of Stage 3, the dominant culture in 49% of workplace tribes in the United States, is "I'm great," or more fully, "I'm great, and you're not." Normally, doctors operate at this level on their best days, as do professors, attorneys, and salespeople. Within the Stage 3 culture, knowledge is power, so people hoard it, from client contacts to gossip about the company. People at Stage 3 have to win, and for them, winning is personal. They'll outwork and outthink their competitors on an individual basis. The mood that results is a collection of lone warriors, wanting help and support, and being continually disappointed that others don't live up to their ambition or skill. Because they have to do the tough work, remembering that others just aren't as savvy, their complaint is that they don't have enough time or competent support. The gravity that holds people at stage three is the addictive hit they get from winning, besting others, being the smartest and the most successful. Before we judge people at this stage as having big egos, we have to remember that society made them, us, this way. From the time we enter school, the one who knows 2 + 2 = 4 gets a gold star, and then it's our ABCs and a smiley face, an algebra test and an A+, SATs and admission into Stanford, letters of recommendation into an MBA, a great interview and a job offer, and an almost post-coital glow of success. If 30 years of reinforcement aren't enough, go to Barnes & Noble and look over the books in the business section. From Machiavelli to Robert Greene's The 48 Laws of Power to anything with Donald Trump's picture on it, helping people get to and maintain stage three is a multi-billion dollar industry. Once Griffin moved people to the point where they took individual responsibility for crafting a patient experience, they had moved to stage three. Like most professionals, our careers have been spent in and among stage three. It's most common in pockets of companies where success is measured on an individual basis, in sales and among executives. We've seen it in architecture, real estate, healthcare, law, and a place we know very well, the university. A typical faculty meeting shows the limitation of stage three. One professor after another gives his opinion and says what he thinks should be done. The result is that most educational programs look as if they've been designed by a committee, because they were. Students often ask if faculty ever speak to one another, and the answer is not often, at least not about important topics. People show up, do their individual research, teach their classes in a manner described by IDEO's David Kelly as a sage on stage, and then leave. Staff members often gripe that professors see only their little corner of the world, and in many cases the criticism is legitimate. Organizations run by Stage 3 behavior feel dehumanizing. As one former aerospace manager told us, "I thought I was loved until I left. Now I don't even get a Christmas card from anyone." As with Stage 2, no amount of team building will turn this group of self-described star players into a team. Give it a new strategy, and tribal members will show either that they embrace it more than others or that they don't need it. Again, the focus of tribal leadership is to upgrade the tribal culture first. Chapter 6 and 7 give the leverage points for Stage 3. Stage 4. The gulf between I'm great, Stage 3, and we're great, Stage 4, is huge, Grand Canyon huge. This level represents 22% of workplace tribal cultures, where the theme of people's communication is we're great. Although Griffin spikes into Stage 5, it is mostly a Stage 4 company. When two people at the hospital meet in the hallways, they're excited about being with another member of the tribe. Take the tribe away, and the person's sense of self suffers a loss. As we watch, Bill Pulwanda is fully himself, and people are fully themselves. No corporate cult here. Everyone seems happy, inspired, and genuine. You see it on people's faces as Charmel works the room, and it's equally true that the room works Charmel. In leading a tribe with a dominant Stage 4 culture, the leader feels pulled by the group. At times, tribal leadership at this stage is effortless. A most impressive characteristic and display of confidence as we toured Griffin was that everybody, staff, volunteers, doctors, made eye contact with us, which is highly unusual in medicine. As we watched a Griffin meeting from a distance, the overall vibe of the room is tribal pride, which is the mood that results from a Stage 4 culture. A we're great tribe always has an adversary. The need for it is hardwired into the DNA of this cultural stage. In fact, the full expression of the theme is we're great and they're not. For USC football, the they're not is usually UCLA, and in good years, whichever team is contending for the national championship. A tribe will seek its own competitor, and the only one who has any influence over the target is the tribal leader. Pulwanda has argued that Griffin's only worthy competitor is the entire way of doing business in healthcare. The rule for Stage 4 is this: the bigger the foe, the more powerful the tribe. Griffin would not be the success it is if it were to target a single hospital as its rival. Chapter 8 is the realm of tribal leadership. When groups get to this point, they see themselves as a tribe with a common purpose. They commit to shared core values and hold one another accountable. They will not tolerate behavior we see in the TV show The Office or the personal agenda of Stage 3. Fully 3/4 of tribes operate below Stage 4, and those in the zone of tribal leadership haven't stabilized at this level. As a result, they oscillate in and out of I'm great, Stage 3. The purpose of this audiobook is to build great companies, and this means getting you and your tribe to Stage 4. Since tribes only move one stage at a time, only those at 4 can make leaps into the most advanced stage, described next. Stage 5. Stage 4 is the launching pad for Stage 5. When we explain this last stage, which reflects less than 2% of workplace tribal cultures, we see skeptical looks coming back at us. Stage 5's t-shirt would read, "Life is great," and they haven't been doing illicit substances. Their language revolves around infinite potential and how the group is going to make history, not to beat a competitor, but because doing so will make a global impact. This group's mood is innocent wonderment. with people in competition with what's possible, not with another tribe. Teams at Stage 5 have produced miraculous innovations. The team that produced the first Macintosh was at Stage 5, and we've seen this mood at Amgen. This stage is pure leadership, vision, and inspiration. After a short burst of activity, Stage 5 teams recede to Stage 4 to regroup and attend to infrastructure issues before possibly returning to 5. In sports, these bursts win Olympic gold and Super Bowl rings. In business, these explosions of leadership make history. Griffin is a model for the best organizations in the world as its culture oscillates between Stage 4 and Stage 5. Log on to our website for a table that shows the 5 stages of tribal development. Our website is www.triballeadership.net. You can take the person out of the tribe. In the Austin Powers movies, Mini-Me was always a loyal follower, but she had to keep up with who had his loyalty. When backing Dr. Evil, Mini-Me would stop at nothing to kill or harass Austin Powers. When his allegiance switched to Austin, our little hero then attempted to take out his old master's influence. It might be said that we are all Mini-Me's for the cultures that dominate our tribes. When a person soaks long enough in a Stage 3 tribe, she becomes an ambassador for that culture, even when moved to other environments. At the same time, the culture the person soaked in was shaped by her influence. People's default stage and the cultures around them mold each other. Over time, the language the person speaks and that of the tribal stage sync up. You might say that Mini-Me and his boss shape each other. We can predict the performance of the tribe by counting the number of people who speak the language of each stage and noticing who is in positions of leadership. The number one factor that makes Griffin extraordinary after its turnaround is the number of Stage 4 people who talk Stage 4 language. If someone at Griffin were to talk the language of Stage 1 or 2, the tribe would reject that person. When the old CEO fired Charmel, the tribe refused to accept that decision. That's the power of tribes. They accept who we are, or they mold us. If we reject their advice, they ostracize us. Very few people have the ability to change a tribe's dominant stage. Those people are tribal leaders. Each person in this tribe is on a journey through the stages, and the tribe makes this journey long or short. The job of you as the tribal leader is to expedite this journey for each person so that a new critical mass forms at Stage 4. When this happens, the tribe will see itself as a tribe, just as Griffin does, and embrace you as the leader. This is tribal leadership in a nutshell. The promise of moving to the next stage. The tribal cultures form a bell curve with its peak at Stage 3. Shifting the center of this distribution from Stage 3 to 4 makes the tribe visible to itself and others, as was the case in Griffin and in the young American colonies at the time of George Washington. We've whispered in the ears of dozens of tribal leaders as they have created stable Stage 4 cultures, resulting in the following benefits. People collaborate and work toward a noble cause, propelled from their values. Fear and stress go down as the interpersonal friction of working together decreases. The entire tribe shifts from resisting leadership to seeking it out. People seek employment in the company and stay, taking the company a long way toward winning the war for talent. People's engagement in work increases as they go from quit on the job but still on the payroll to fully participating. Organizational learning becomes effortless, with the tribe actively teaching its members the latest thinking and practices. People's overall health statistics improve, injury rates and sick days go down. Setting and implementing a successful competitive strategy becomes stunningly easy as people's aspirations, knowledge of the market, and creativity are unlocked and shared. Most exciting for us is that people report feeling more alive and having more fun. In short, companies with tribes at the later stages earn more, employ better performers, and upgrade the performers they have, serve their markets, and have a blast doing it. Everyone wins, except those individuals unwilling or unable to adapt from stages 2 and 3. The next chapter is your navigation guide to this audiobook. Most corporate tribes are mostly at stage 3 or below. Where's yours? The next chapter will help you find out, give you a few rules of the tribal road, and then direct you to the chapter that will give you the tools to nudge your group to the next level.